We're now ready to start with number 17 on our pioneer chart here, our timeline of the 27 pioneers. And this pioneer is named Ellen G. White. Probably of all the pioneers, there's probably more written about this one than there are about any of the other ones.
And by.
Not only about her, but by her as well, for sure. And so it will be a very short overview of some of the key things in her life. Again, to review of the issues that we've done, which overlap those of her husband, Volume 5 of Lest We Forget, were devoted to, the issues of Volume 5 were devoted to James and Ellen White. Volume 5, number 1, featuring James and Ellen White. Volume 5, number 2, after October 22, 1844. And then Volume 5, number 3, mostly is James White, then Volume 5, number 4, is particularly Ellen White. And you'll see that it's unusual because these are usually 8 pages long. This one is 12 pages long. So we added 4 extra pages on the issue that particularly highlighted Ellen White. But that's the issue that has details about the timeline in her life that I've drawn most of the timeline here from. And of course, we have a picture of her on the top there beside James White. In this collection of pioneers that we're building story by story here. So let's begin with the outline that we have of her. I've given you again the references to the issues that we've published on her, unless we forget. If you forget what I referred to, they're there at the top of the handout. Ellen Gould White was born Ellen Harmon on November 26, 1827. To Eunice and Robert Harmon in Gorham, Maine, with another sibling. She had a twin born at the same time named Elizabeth.
Where did she get that middle name?
I don't know. Does anyone know where she got the name Gould?
Relative.
Is the relative that was named that? Okay.
There was a number of Goulds.
Okay.
Or people that had the name Gould and
okay. Number of relatives with that name. At the age of 9, 1836, we would be calculated to be. She was injured in the face by a thrown stone while in the third grade. Never returned to formal schooling, though she tried once, some 3 years later. 3 years later, March of 1840, she heard William Miller preach. She's 12 years of age in Portland, Maine. She responded with conviction, but she did not have peace or freedom. If you read her stories, her descriptions of her early years, conscientious young lady with convictions, but lacking very much in terms of peace. And this factors into what we're going to see here in these early descriptions of her. The summer of 40, at the age of 12, she attended a Methodist camp meeting in Buxton, Maine. She was much encouraged by a discourse on Esther. And what was it in the story of Esther? Esther says, I will go into the king, and if I perish, I perish. And the speaker told the congregation, go to the king. He will reach out his scepter, you know. And so she was encouraged because she felt herself to be a doubting one, because it was like she didn't have assurance that God really had accepted her. And he encouraged the doubting ones to surrender to God and venture upon his mercy without delay, is how she described it. And here's some of her own descriptions from that time. As I knelt and prayed, suddenly my burden left me and my heart was light. At first a feeling of alarm came over me and I tried to resume my load of distress. It seemed to me that I had no right to feel joyous and happy. But Jesus seemed very near to me. I felt able to come to him with all my griefs, misfortunes, and trials, even as the needy ones came to him for relief when he was upon the earth, even as Esther went to the king, you know, there was a surety in my heart that he understood my peculiar trials and sympathized with me. I can never forget this precious assurance of the pitying tenderness of Jesus toward one so unworthy of his notice. I learned more of the divine character of Christ in that short period when bowed among the praying ones than ever before. Life Sketches 23. what happened? There was a lady who was concerned for the young people, and she describes her as a mother in Israel. One of the mothers in Israel came to me and said, "Dear child, have you found Jesus?" I was about to answer yes when she exclaimed, "Indeed you have. His peace is with you. I see it in your face." So your face reveals you. Countenance. That was Life Sketches, page 24. 1841, age of 14. She was so weak, she had to be propped up in bed to work. She was working with her father. Her father made hats, and she was helping with that project. And if you read about it, they were so convicted of the Advent message that they were earning money as children and buying Advent literature, spending all their money to buy Advent literature to share with people. And she's a, you know, early teen doing that. The description that we have, unless we forget, of this period of time goes like this. Her religious experience progressed from perplexity over the Methodist doctrine of justification and sanctification to hunger and thirst for full salvation, to rejoicing over a renewed understanding of the plan of salvation, and testifying to other youth of her joy in Christ and hope for his soon coming. Say it again?
Similar to Luther.
Oh, okay. It was similar to Martin Luther. Yeah.
Yeah, but you that's think about this.
Of her own unworthiness and then a revelation of mercy. That
conviction of her unworthiness and then his acceptance and mercy. Yes.
Yeah, but you think about it. This was a kid, 14
that's right.
years
old. That's right.
How many 14-year-old kids do you know that even think one third?
Exactly. Exactly. And that comes up in what we're going to see here because it's not over with her struggle. June of 42, age 14, in June of 1842, Mr. Miller gave his second course of lectures at the Casco Street Church in Portland. I felt it a great privilege to attend these lectures, for I had fallen under discouragements and did not feel prepared to meet my Savior. This second course created much more excitement in the city than the first. With few exceptions, the different denominations closed the doors of their churches against Mr. Miller. So this is 1842. Long before the second angel's message began to sound in 1844, the churches were already closing their doors. And it was a result of this attitude. This is before any disappointments had come to the Advent believers in terms of time passing. So we need to see that already the churches were closing doors. And it, actually, that attitude is what led to the second angel's message to begin to be proclaimed sometime later. That was from Life Sketches, page 26. That same month, June the 26th, age 14, she's baptized by immersion by the Methodist minister in the sea with 11 others. The Methodist minister believed that both modes of baptism were appropriate, sprinkling or immersion. But there were some who read the Bible and said, "I want to be baptized by immersion." And so he was willing to do that, and there were 11 others with her, so there are 12. And they went down to the ocean to be baptized. And her descriptions of it are interesting, the waves and all of that. She joined the Methodist church, but she was confused over justification and sanctification. And again, she had no real acceptance by God. She eventually had some dreams. I didn't reference them here, but she had two dreams. These were not her visions that she had starting after the passing of the time. These were dreams. But they were dreams specifically for her to encourage her. And it was after she had those dreams, one of which she was shown a coil of rope, which she was shown keep near her heart, that was sort of a symbol of her connection with Jesus. Was it green? I'm trying to remember. It was green. I think green is a symbol of faith. Gold is also in Scripture. But after those dreams, she had a confidence finally to confide in her mother. She had not even been telling her mother what she had been going through. She confided in her mother, and her mother sent her to Elder Stockman, who was an older gentleman who obviously her mother knew would be sensitive to her daughter and would be able to minister to her spirit, which is vitally important. And this is when she met Elder Stockman. John, Elder Stockman said, "Your experience is very unusual for someone your age. Very unusual. God has something special in mind for your life." Yeah, something like that. Did you have a comment too?
Well, Stockman was laid to rest.
Right, exactly. Stockman was laid to rest later as well.
You said that this was unusual?
Yes, that her experience at that age was very unusual. the sensitivity that she had and the concern that she had for acceptance by God. And this is what he told her. Go free, Ellen, said he. Return to your home trusting in Jesus, for he will not withhold his love from any true seeker. He then prayed earnestly for me, and it seemed that God would certainly regard the prayer of his saint. Even if my humble petitions were unheard, my mind was much relieved, and the wretched slavery of doubt and fear departed as I listened to the wise and tender counsel of this teacher in Israel. I left his presence comforted and encouraged. During the few minutes in which I received instruction from Elder Stockman, I had obtained more knowledge on the subject of God's love and pitying tenderness than from all the sermons and exhortations to which I had ever listened. Maybe he was an Elder Layman. Those of you who know Pastor Layman. Someone of the same, obviously, spirit and conviction that could convey the tenderness and love that God has for every individual. Very, very effective in doing that. Hope, conveying hope to people who are struggling with doubt and uncertainty.
Yeah, there's no way that a 14-year-old kid can think like that.
Yeah, that's right.
About God.
Right. Yeah, a 14-year-old does not naturally lean that way. That's right. Holy Spirit was working with her.
This sort of just reminds me right now of Mary, when God sought for someone to be the mother of that baby.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps at this moment, God saw that this was the right role to
play
for this particular circumstance.
Right.
For the person that he was going to have this prophet to be.
Mm-hmm. Looking for that willingness, like Mary of old. 1843, she's 16. The Harmon family is expelled from the Methodist Church in September. Expelled because they believed in the advent of Christ. So this is, again, not only were they closing the doors of the churches to Miller preaching, they began to close the doors to their own members and put them out of the churches if they believed in that. She describes that it's described for us in her first volume of biography, page 44. 1844, she's 17 years old. She's looking for the coming of Christ. To the end of 1843, that's how she describes it in Life Sketches. And it was a little bit confusing as I looked at this. The only way I could make sense of that was that the way they described 1843 must have been on the Jewish year, because later in Great Controversy, page 391, and volume 1 of the biography, page 46, they speak of it as being the spring of 44, was when they were looking toward. So Life Sketches, page 57, says the end of 43. Great Controversy, 391, and volume 1 of the biography, 46, says it's the spring of 44. Midnight Cry comes, again, as we mentioned, the summer of 44, and points to the fall of 1844. 10th day, 7th month movement, October 22 of that year. What does she say about that year? Life Sketches, page 59. This was the happiest year of my life. My heart was full of glad expectation, but I felt great pity and anxiety for those who were in discouragement and had no hope in Jesus. We united as a people in earnest prayer for a true experience and the unmistakable evidence of our acceptance with God. The fall comes, the disappointment occurs. She is herself very ill with tuberculosis, bleeding from the tuberculosis even. It's mentioned in volume 1 of the biography, page 55. And here's how she describes, we read James's description of what that event was like. Here's how she describes it. The waiting people of God approached the hour when they fondly hoped their joys would be complete in the coming of the Savior, but the time again passed, just as it had earlier in that year of 43. The time, spring of 44. The time again passed unmarked by the advent of Jesus, it was a bitter disappointment that fell upon the little flock whose faith had been so strong and whose hope had been so high. But we were surprised. We were surprised that we felt so free in the Lord and were so strongly sustained by His strength and grace. Very interesting comment. They were surprised that they were not just devastated totally. And then December of that year, a couple months later, the precise day in December is not documented anywhere that I am aware of. She's gathered in prayer, and there were those who would gather in prayer to pray over the Advent message still after the passing of time. And they're gathered in prayer, and she has her first vision. And it's in early writings, pages 13 to 21. You might want to read it again to review that amazing description. Regarding the travels of the Advent people, remember she was looking for them, and she couldn't see them. And the angel said, look again, and look a little higher. And she looked above the world, and she saw this path. Travels of the Advent people to the city of God with the midnight cry. At the beginning of the path, bright light, shining, partially lighting the way. Because I say partially because Jesus was there. They were able to see Him, and He had light with Him too. And so there's light coming from the beginning of the path. There's light coming from Jesus. And they're needing to follow Him and follow the light, right? Very significant imagery there. The next year, 1845, she's 17 years of age still, she meets James for the first time that she recalls in Orrington, Maine. And again, volume of the biography, page 70, documents that. That's her memory of meeting him for the first time.
What was the difference of years?
James?
About 6 years.
James was born in 21. She's born in 27. 6 years and 3 months about. Maybe a little bit more than 3 months. August of 21 to November of 27. In 1846, at the age of 19, she learns of the Sabbath truth from Joseph Bates, did not feel it was important. That year is when she married James White in August, but by the fall they began keeping the Sabbath, became convicted of that. Again, on her outline here, I'm listing the children as well as like I did on James's outline. 1847, she's 20 years of age, she's traveling, speaking. She has her first child, Henry, born in Topsom, Maine. 2 years later, at the age of 22, second child, James Edson, is born in Rocky Hill, Connecticut. And in August of 51, age of 23, she has her first book published. Now remember on the review that we did of James, he had published The Word to the Little Flock in May of 47. So this book is being published over 4 years later. And this is the title of the book. This is how he describes it in the Word to the Little Flock. Early writings is what references that. In August 1851, her first book, A Sketch of the Christian Experience and Views of Ellen G. White, was published at Saratoga Springs, New York. Recall Saratoga Springs, just north of Albany. Among the articles which comprise this work of 64 pages are the last two just referred to, which appeared in A Word to the Little Flock, which, as we said, was published in 47. The first Ellen G. White vision, which was from December of 44, and the letter to Elder Bates. And the references for those are early writings, pages 13 to 20, and 32 to 35. 1854, at the age of 27, her third child, William Clarence, was born in Rochester, New York. And again, these early decades, they were married in 46, so they have about half of that decade. They were traveling together before they got married, so you very well could say the entire half of that decade, the last half of the 1840s. The 1850s, there's a lot of traveling that they're doing. Speaking, traveling, writing. They were frequently in very poor health and disabilities. They were very, very poor. They had very, very, very little means. Sometimes James actually had to go and find some other work to do to earn some money to keep the ministry going. By and large, obviously, they would be supported by people who, as they travel, would give them money, you know, and support them that way. Because anybody who's thinking would realize that these people have no other means of support. And so they would give them a free will offering type of thing. Many times during their illnesses, there were prayers in their behalf and miraculous restorations. Story after story. What was that?
That must have been in the case with tuberculosis.
Yes.
That sounds right. Almost terrible.
Yeah. Yeah. When you're bleeding from tuberculosis, there was...
No, that's that way with the early pioneers at that time, because they didn't have a helpmate.
Exactly.
You know, William Hyde and, mm-hmm. and Francis Collin.
Right.
And
right. They didn't have any way of doing it other than like the early disciples, by prayers and laying on of hands. They had not been given the light of the health message yet. They moved to Michigan again in 1855, left Rochester, and made that move out to Michigan. And their fourth child, John Herbert, was born in Battle Creek, but it died the same year as we recounted. Born in September, died in December, when she was 33 years old. 1863, age of 35, on June the 6th, she has her first extensive vision on health reform. Again, the Lord's beginning to have mercy on these people to show them how they can prevent disease and to treat it with natural methods. Very much needed, a personal need. There was one time when all the workers were incapacitated and unable to work. And so it's a very practical thing that God is giving to them. There was a decision to stop eating flesh foods and spices. December of that year was when Henry died. 1864, at the age of 37, she begins a two-meal-a-day program, and she loses 25 pounds. So, as I recall, she was fairly short in stature. Was she 5'2", I think someone said? Does anyone recall her height? I think that's what?
I think it was close to
that. Close to that, yeah. This weight loss, I would imagine, was a healthy weight loss, to some extent at least. Sometimes people can lose more than they need to. 1865, 38 years of age, there are six articles published on disease and its cause. Six articles that she wrote, and it's published in How to Live. Okay? The same year, James is paralyzed, and she devotes 18 months to his recovery. So she has been given now information on health, and she's been given a husband who needs intense practical application of it. Yes. They were in the country. They also went to New York for this recovery at the Danville Institute, the Oracure Institute there. 1866 was when they opened the Western Health Reform Institute. So it's that vision on health and the what flowed out of that, the institution they opened, the periodical they started publishing, the Health Reformer, these were meeting their own needs, not just needs of people in the world. It was meeting their needs and the people in the world as well. And 1869, the record is that she's 42. She purchased with James $1,500 of stock in the Western Health Reform Institute that had been open for about 3 years there. So people are supporting it by actually investment. 1872, age of 47, she helps form the first SDA school in Battle Creek, and she travels to California for the first time. That first trip that she made there with James on the railroad. 73, she's spending time in Colorado. They had relatives in Colorado, and they really enjoyed the mountains. So read about those experiences there. Beg your pardon? You're right. That's a typo. She was 48 years of age at the time she was in Colorado. And then, 1877, she addresses 500 members of the Women's Christian Temperance Union in a Mammoth Tent in Battle Creek. I thought that was important to put in because she not only spoke to Adventists in her travels, in her dealing with people, she spoke to non-Adventists as well. And this is one of the organizations that she saw very much a open door to give the health message, the temperance message.
Temperance was her favorite subject.
Temperance was her favorite subject. It's good. She was treated in Battle Creek Sanitarium. Again, they used our sanitarium for our own problems and ill health very frequently. She was back in California. She stayed with James, and then she returned. She stayed in California, I meant to say, there in 1877 when James returned to Battle Creek Sanitarium for treatment. 1878, she's still on the West Coast, age 51. She travels by boat out of San Francisco, goes up to Oregon. Again, that was the best way to get to Oregon in those days. Boat up the coast to Portland. And later that year, she met James and Willie in Colorado, and they went on to Battle Creek for more treatment at the sanitarium and the General Conference session. Then they went down to Texas, and she traveled down there with James.
Not me, I just said this place in Colorado was near her sister.
Okay.
She was married to Mr. Walling.
Was this Elizabeth, her sister? Or another one of the sisters?
Another
sister. Another.
And she later raised the two children, May and Addie Walling.
Oh, okay.
And he had a mill there.
Okay.
There was a cabin, I have a picture of it, where they could stay.
Okay. This is in Colorado. Her brother-in-law, Mr. Walling, had a mill, and they could stay there. And the comment was that she later raised were they daughters, May and Addie?
They were granddaughters.
Granddaughters.
Yeah. Her sister wasn't very well and
okay.
had some emotional problems. And
okay.
So, and he later sued.
They were nieces? Ellen White's nieces? Okay.
Addie and May Walling.
Right. Yeah,
he owned a lot of property and had mail, and there was one cabin that was set aside for
okay.
him to stay in.
Cabin for them. Yeah, she did help to raise them, and then later on he sued her for alienation of affection because you know she'd done a lot of raising them, and they obviously became attached to her. And
she settled out of court. She didn't want to put the girls through testifying.
Right. Ellen White settled out of court. 1881, at the age of 54, her husband dies in Battle Creek. And again, I would refer you to her CD-ROM. And on the CD-ROM, there's a document entitled In Memoriam, where she recounts those last weeks with him and his new devotional experience that he was having before he died, not knowing he was going to die. They were actually making plans. She traveled to Colorado and then to California, same year. 1883... she made her 17th crossing of the American Plain. So this lady is going back and forth by train. You know, that would be a total of probably eight or nine round trips crossing the plains on the train. 85, she's 58. She makes a trip to Europe, England, Switzerland, Denmark, Sweden, France, and Italy. She's there until 1887. And upon return, shortly after that in 87, the Minneapolis Conference in 88 occurs. She's 61 years of age. She hears E.J. Wagner and A.T. Jones speak at Minneapolis, and she endorses the message very powerfully. This is again where she states that when she heard Wagner, it was the clearest explanation on this topic that she had heard from human lips outside of conversations with her husband, which apparently were those years right before he died in 81 when he became convicted that they must write on the glorious subject of redemption, of redemption that God was opening to their mind. She traveled extensively with Jones and Wagner in the months following the Minneapolis meetings and struggled against unbelievable opposition to take the message to the churches and to Battle Creek itself. It's an amazing study. It's probably one of the most significant portions of our history that we need to come to grips with. And I would encourage you, if you want to really understand that history, that you go through the Ellen G. White 1888 materials. Because that's her own descriptions of what was happening, arranged in chronological order. She's not writing a history of it per se. She's writing about it. And it's arranged in the order in which it's it comes up in her writings, letters, manuscripts, articles, sermons, and she's referencing it over and over again. Very, very significant. Actually, the most passionate letter that I think I've ever read by her is not in the 1888 materials, but refers to the light of 1888. It's a letter that she wrote 4 years after Minneapolis. She wrote it November, which would be 4 years to the very month, because the meetings went into November in 88. November she wrote in 1892 to the GC president. And the letter is entitled The Need for a Converted Ministry. And in that letter, she says, the truth that has been set before us the past few years is immense in its importance, reaching into heaven and compassing eternity.
You said that was November
1892? Yes. That's on the CD-ROM. If you have the index to the letters, look up the November letter to O.A. Olson. And find the reference. It's actually in pamphlet number 2, page 25. If you look at pamphlet number 2, page 25, the code is PH002, as I recall, because there's over 100 pamphlets, so they had to put zeros to make it up. Page 25, the entire letter is an amazing letter. She says, after how important the truth was, that Satan has done everything to block this. And you can imagine why, because if this is a message that will equip God's people for what they need, and then what, in turn, the world needs, this could bring a rapid conclusion to the mission of the Advent movement. And the devil, he doesn't want it to stop, right? He wants, the longer it's prolonged, the longer he has to do whatever he likes to do. The truth that has been set before us the past few years. And the only thing that obviously, she references in the letter the ministerial institutes, which is what Prescott helped to devise after Minneapolis. When Prescott grasped what Minneapolis was all about, he began to devise ministerial institutes to train ministers to hear the light of the message of righteousness by faith. And so she references those institutes in this letter. And so we know that she's talking about that. That's the light of 1888. She says, the truth has been set before us the past few years is immense in its importance. Reaching into heaven and compassing eternity, time and space. She's grasping for words to describe how important this is. And she's grieving. The letter is a heart lament over the fact that the ministry is not getting it. And she says, they're going on in their foolish virgin way. And they look at it as if it was a horse or a cow to buy, if the term suited them. But they didn't realize that this is not just something that you buy if you think you need it. This is something that you're going to die without. This is essential for you. And they didn't realize the importance of it. And she pours her heart out. It's a lament, if I've ever read one, by Ellen White.
They didn't realize their practical need.
Yes. And she realized that often the people rise no higher than the ministers. So she's writing the GC president, and again, the title of the letter was The Need for a Converted Ministry. She's writing to the angel of the church, if you please, in the language of Revelation 2 and 3. So that's what was happening there. 3 years later, 1891, age of 64, I believe as a fallout from the opposition to Minneapolis, there is a vote made to send her to Australia to help start the mission work, the Adventist work there in Australia.
Exile.
And she went there reluctantly at the invitation of the General Conference. It was a form of exile based on her own evidence, her own testimony, because in the middle of her time in Australia, she wrote back to the GC president describing to him what was behind the move to Australia. And she said, you did not want the voice in your midst. And God gave you what you wanted, and the results are before you. And the results were that Battle Creek went from bad to worse during the 1890s. Not everything was bad, but it was so bad that about a year after she got back, two of the main institutions burned to the ground.
And the very opposite, and the devil's was in
the works. In the works. The closest counterfeit to the message of righteousness by faith is pantheism. Mm-hmm. And when the light was rejected, the devil had his counterfeit to come in to appear to be still the genuine message. And that was the danger that came later on. We're back now to the 90s, though. Beginning of the 90s, she's gone to Australia. Mid-90s, she moves, age of 68, to make her home near the Avondale School, which they've opened up during the years that she's there. And she lives there, a place called Sunnyside, until she leaves Australia. She's there until 1900, and she returns at the age of 73. If you actually read her writings, she actually expects to spend the rest of her life in Australia. She has no plans at one point to return to America. But the Lord makes it clear, time to go back, your work's not finished there yet. And so she gets, you can imagine, this is not easy, packing up your whole household, selling everything you can't take, and moving back across the ocean. You know? And she's doing it. During the years that she was there, she didn't ignore Battle Creek. She just had to write a month earlier than what they needed it. And the Lord, time and again, would impress her to send something off, you know, because it took about a month for the mail to get there. So the Lord kept messages going to Battle Creek. But her time was occupied in Australia, too. She was doing work there. So Battle Creek did suffer, even though it was not neglected totally. It did suffer. 1900, she returns to the U.S., age of 73. She purchases a home in Elmshaven after looking around the Bay Area to try to find something. The Lord provides that for her. And a very interesting experience finding that and the lovely spot that it was. Those of you who visited, you can perhaps imagine what it would be like if you get rid of all the other houses and places that have just sort of built in and crowded this beautiful Victorian house there. Quite a bit. 1902, age of 75, she's grieved when fires destroyed the Battle Creek Sanitarium in February, the Review and Herald Publishing House in December, and clearly she's told that these are judgments of God. And one of the references I gave you there as to where she refers to those. 1903, age of 76, she writes the most number of letters and manuscripts in her life. That year, 1903, she wrote 472 letters and manuscripts. If you recall at an earlier review that we did of the year of 1902, which was the year before this, what building project had they had at Elmshaven in 1902? Exactly. They had built her writing room above the kitchen. And this was the first full year after that, and she used it. Wrote and wrote and wrote and wrote and wrote. 472 letters and manuscripts.
Cabinet built. Three rows of file drawers that would hold her manuscripts.
Okay.
And she had it there handy. Ones that she wanted, the rest were kept in the vault.
Okay. So she had a cabinet to hold things handy there. That's a very efficient place. And you can imagine, after years of traveling, having a place now where she could really focus. And this is what she really wanted to do. To focus on her writings. It's not that she never traveled anymore, but they struggled. As I perceive it, two things distracted her from her writings. Invitations to come and speak, and people coming and visiting her. You know, you have to be hospitable, don't you? Someone knocks at your door. But you can see, and she did have a team of people that helped her more than probably she'd had before, which was really instrumental. Beneficial as well.
Yeah, when she traveled earlier, I mean, she couldn't refer back to her other manuscripts.
Right.
She was totally having to
right.
pray and go from memory.
Exactly. Traveling really disrupts you. I can testify to that, getting things done at home and in a continuing fashion that you'd like to do that. 1905, age of 78, she counsels John Burden to purchase the property at Loma Linda, where we sit at present. And there's a lot of stories behind all of these things. We could spend a lot of time looking at it. But 1909, the age of 81, in the spring, she attends her last general conference session. And it's interesting to to consider, you know, what she talks about there at the last time that she's at the GC session. In 1914, 5 years later, age of 86, she wrote her last letter. Did you know it's published at the end of Testimonies to Ministers? I give you the reference there, 516 to 521. Would you like to hear the first paragraph of the letter? Dear friend, the Lord has given me a message for you, and not for you only, but also for other faithful souls who are troubled by doubts and fears regarding their acceptance by the Lord Jesus Christ. This is back to the teenage Ellen. Can you believe it? She's writing about lessons that she learned when she was, 72 years younger. His word to you is, fear not, for I have redeemed thee. I have called thee by thy name, thou art mine. You desire to please the Lord, and you can do this by believing his promises. He is waiting to take you into a harbor of gracious experience, and he bids you be still and know that I am God. You have had a time of unrest, but Jesus says to you, come unto me, and I will give you rest. The joy of Christ is in the soul. The joy of Christ in the soul is worth everything. Then are they glad because they are privileged to rest in the arms of everlasting love. That's the 86-year-old Ellen White writing her last letter. That's the first paragraph. Read the rest of it. I encourage you to go through that. And then, 1915... July the 16th, she dies at the age of 87. I've given you on this handout something that you may or may not have noticed. Along the right-hand side, in those last years, actually, it's over a half of her life, from 1855 onward, I've given you a series of dark lines. You notice those along the right-hand margin? If you look at it carefully, there's 9 lines. These are the 9 testimonies of the church and the periods of time that the testimonies cover. I've done a partial analysis of the testimonies in the times in which they are they're covering. And so if you actually want the dates, I can give them to you. I didn't try to squeeze the dates in here. The first one is volume 1 of the testimonies. But these volumes are the ones that we call our volumes now. To begin with, they were testimony number 1, testimony number 2, and what we have, volume 1, was actually testimonies numbers 1 through 14, which they were published as little booklets to start with, and then they compiled 1 through 14 and made volume 1 of the testimonies. So this first long line goes from 1855 down to 1868. Volume 1 of the testimonies covers from 1855 to 1868, 14 years. Volume 2 covers from 1868 to 1871, 4 years. I'm doing these numbers inclusive. Volume 3 of the testimonies is 1872 to 1875. 1872 to 1875, 4 years. So you can see I'm trying to sort of match the rows there that these are corresponding to. Volume 4 of the testimonies, 1875 to 1881, 7 years. Then volume 5 of the testimonies is 1882 to 1889, 8 years. And then volume 6 of the testimonies is 1891 to 1900. Now, from what we've studied, what period does that cover, 1891 to 1900? Australia years. That's exactly what happened. She did not release any testimonies in Australia. She just collected them. And then they published them all upon her return, and that was the Australian testimonies. Volume 6 is the Australian testimonies. 10 years. 10 years worth of them, 1891 to 1900. Volume 7, it's interesting, the next two come out in rapid order, because there's crises. Volume 7, 1901 to 1902. Okay? 1901, the great reorganization of the General Conference. 1902, the fires that occur in Battle Creek. Those are the two-year period there. And then Volume 8, 1903 to 1904, two-year period. 1903, again, is the year that she wrote the most letters and manuscripts. This is the year that Kellogg publishes his book, The Living Temple. Okay? 1904 is where he's defending it at the meetings in Berrien Springs. And Jones is joining him, and Prescott's opposing it. And amazing things happening there. Volume 8. Maybe sometime we'll go through these in more detail, because there are summaries of what topics are covered, and it's useful, I think, to see the testimonies in this historical context. And then Volume 9, 1904 to 1909. So that's 6 years before she dies. But it covers a six-year period, 1904 to 1909. And that's the periods of the Volume 9 of the Testimonies. So that gives you another little summary there along the side of what she did there in terms of the testimony. The Testimonies isn't all that she wrote. We could spend some time outlining on a timeline the other books, what she released in the other books. So you have letters and manuscripts, you have books, and you have these testimonies to the church. Particularly in the early years, they're letters. Some of them also include manuscripts. She would write on a topic. The Lord impressed her to write on a topic, and it was not specifically directed to anyone, but it was a topic that the church needed. And so, when you see them in their historical context, that makes a lot of sense, because they're addressing current needs, crises, development of work, mission outreach, working for the cities. Major sections on working for the cities at one point there, turn of the century, when that became a demographic reality in the United States. So that is basically the summary of Ellen White's life that we want to look at. Again, if you want a thorough biography, go through Arthur White's six volumes, which is a good overview of her life. It's been summarized into one volume called Woman of Vision. Condense six into one, if you can imagine that. Her own life sketches are a tremendous resource to review some of those things. But again, an amazing life to review. And it's very significant, too, because her life very much parallels the life, the events of the Advent movement in those early years. And very useful to see it through those eyes. James, I think, actually in describing her life experience, describes it in that context, that it very much parallels the Advent movement too.
If you know, when we look over here, when she was young, and she was impressed by that discourse on Esther, mm-hmm. and she was
Yes.
That's right.
That's right.
I just came to my mind.
That's right. Right. Esther was born for such a time as that. And she was willing to say, if I perish, I perish. And she'll venture on the Lord, on the Lord's mercy.
Here's something to think about, Fred. Mm-hmm. Here's a girl, 9 years old until the day she died, was in relatively poor health.
That's right.
Look at all the traveling she did, and the time when traveling was rough.
That's right.
We couldn't even stand up under that now.
Right.
And all the work she did. Mm-hmm. And yet she lived until she was 87 years old mm-hmm. with a clear mind.
Mm-hmm.
Still fighting.
Mm-hmm.
So that's got to tell you something, doesn't
it? It does. Yeah, the testimony is clear that the Lord used her, and not just in a normal way, but in a supernatural way.
And how brilliant she was as a kid.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Very much so. Very much so. Any other observations or things that someone wants to comment on regarding?
The papers you passed out at the first of the meeting today, did you go over those stories?
Yes.
While we were here?
That's correct. And they are all recorded, and they will all be on the internet if you want to view them
off. On your website or on Audioverse?
They will be on the, there'll be a link on the Adventist Pioneer Library website. The ones that are currently there, they're actually under another web address that I've gotten called fredbischoff.com. And the ones, I just have the first two there at present, Miller and Bates. But the other ones are ready. They've been uploaded. I just haven't created the links to them.
Do we still continue with Electric Quartet, or when did it stop?
We did not publish any more, lest we forget, after Volume 12, Number 2. There's still hope to restart it, to do a master timeline. Can you imagine taking all the timelines that we've doing on all of these pioneers and putting them all into one timeline? I've done it, and I'm thinking about actually publishing it in a series of Lest We Forget, where you can open them up like this and then put them side by side. And if you wanted to, you know, like in a classroom, teacher could put them around the wall and just make a continuous timeline of the Advent movement.
And the last was
Volume 12, Number 2. And I think if I start it again, I'm not going to put dates on them. I'm just going to say Volume 12, Number 3 and continue on so that the dates won't be confusing anymore. But I plan to, I like to do the timeline, to do some summaries of the pioneers, and then from there on, and it should be fairly easy to do this, to actually do a extract of pioneers' writings on the things that Ellen White identifies as the landmarks of Adventism. And just give people a sample that don't have the CD-ROM or that don't know how to search it that well. Here's a sample of what this one wrote about this pillar, and this is what this one wrote about this landmark truth. And so you have a sample, and just, you know, in just a few 8 pages, you can read what they wrote.
Some people aren't researchers. And
yeah.
Right.
Right. There's so much on the CD-ROM that you can be overwhelmed. I mean, there's so much there that you will never read it all. And so that I'm thinking, too, that this can be a tour guide that can say, here's something important. Look at this. Search this on the CD-ROM.
Run with it.
Yeah. In other words, here's how I found it myself. Here, you search for these terms and you'll find it. You know, find maybe even more about that.